What's going on, people? Welcome to Pain Point. As usual, I'm your host, Jake Painting. This podcast is proudly brought to you by the SB Nation Network and the Tanis Hoopus Network. Today, we'll be talking a little bit of Timberwolves team building. To join me to do that is Tanis Hoopus contributor, the great friend of the show, Jack Borman. What's going on, man?
I'm doing well, man. How are you?
Yeah, good. So, I know that the draft's coming up and we've kind of spent a lot of time on the draft, but I think we wanted to pivot a little bit today. I'm sure we'll still talk draft picks here and there just because they're so relevant to the Timberwolves team in general, but we thought we'd go a little bit of team building and trade talk and stuff like that. So by the time this comes out, Jack Borman's latest piece has probably hit the web on Candace Hoopus, but it'll be based around Ben Simmons. If you read his Devin Booker article, you would know that Jack is amazing at breaking down players, and it's not he's very impartial. This isn't saying like the Minnesota Timberwolves are certainly going to get Ben Simmons or they're in the driver's seat to get Ben Simmons, but it's more of a breakdown and what you could expect from Simmons, what a deal would look like if Minnesota could, you know, eventually get something over the line. And in general, just really good reading. I know that it'll be a big read because Jack is the master of kind of cramming more thoughts into one article than is humanly possible. So I'll just throw a few questions at you. Like, I haven't read the article, obviously it's not out yet, so I just want to know, like, while we acknowledge that it's unlikely to happen, was there anything you learned or kind of concluded when watching all this Ben Simmons film and when writing a ton of words about him?
Yeah, so the main takeaways that I think I kind of came out with was just that I don't think that there's any player in the NBA, really anywhere in the NBA. I mean, you could argue Giannis, you could argue LeBron, but in my opinion, I don't really think there's anybody that's better playing in space than Ben Simmons is. Just how much ground he's able to cover, whether it be from, you know, above the break with the ball in his hands and a high screen roll, or on the fast break, he's just incredible going to the rim if you give him any bit of space, which is obviously something that stands out if you watch him play more. But and kind of going off that, you know, there's not really a whole lot of space to go around in the 76ers offense. Just considering that they didn't really have any specialty shooters that had any type of shot gravity. And most of their three-point attempts came from, you know, Ben Simmons getting into the lane and kicking the ball out. But without really more than two competent three-point shooters, the two guys that I would say would be the competent three-point shooters would probably be, you know, Furkan Korkmaz and I'm drawing a blank on his name. Good God. And Shake Milton. Those are the kind of the two competent three-point shooters that they had. You know, Harris shot way too many threes for how, you know, mediocre of a shooter he is, and same goes for Josh Richardson. So just the way that he's able to play in space but then also create easy three-point looks for teammates is incredible. But since there's not a whole lot of space in that 76ers offense, you know, I think that he's pretty well held back. And then just the fact that he and Embiid kind of actively hold each other back in the sense that, you know, Simmons can't shoot threes, so it, you know, you can sag off a little bit on him and give more attention to Embiid in the post, but also that Simmons needs room to drive the lane and you don't really want to have a guy like Joel Embiid out on the perimeter. So just that whole conundrum, you know, I think the Sixers are going to eventually break up the Simmons and Embiid duo, just because I think that they have an extremely high floor with those two on the floor, just because they're tremendous individual talents. But when I think you take one of them away or you cash in on one of them, whether it be Simmons or Embiid, I think the team's ceiling grows exponentially, just because you're able to make a more functional and fitting team to have. And obviously, I think if Ben were to end up in Minnesota, just the way that the Timberwolves want to play in terms of getting up and down the floor, and really spacing it out with shooters and getting up in transition and turning defense into offense, I think that he'd be a pretty seamless fit if the Timberwolves were somehow able to swing that. But like you said, in no way is it likely. And in the approach that I took in writing it was very much a this is what Ben Simmons is all about type of angle.
And I guess to keep it through the Minnesota lens, what kind of, obviously we've all watched Ben Simmons, but we haven't probably, you know, broke down the film and studied him like you have been for the last few weeks. What kind of offensive gravity or what do you think he can do on a team like Minnesota, where obviously Karl Anthony Towns needs the ball from both the post and the top of the key or anywhere around the arc, and then also obviously D'Angelo Russell needs the ball as well as a pretty ball dominant kind of pick and roll guard. Like, what do you think Simmons would bring if he was just dropped into that mix as a guy who certainly needs to play off the ball, you know, probably at least half of his possessions?
Yeah, so my thing with Ben is he's really aggressive as a cutter, and because his vision is so good with the ball, he reads the floor really, really well when he doesn't have the ball in his hands. And so he's a really strong cutter when he decides to. You know, I would love to see him cut more, just because I think sometimes when he's on offense, he can kind of take a few plays off if he's relegated to the corner or something like that. But he has the ability to put pressure on the defense on every single possession if he doesn't have the ball in his hands as a cutter, just because he covers so much ground in a short period of time. You know, and has really good hands and can go up and catch the ball and lobs and then cuts as well. And then, so if he were kind of dropped into the Minnesota offense, something that I think he would be really, really strong with would be using him as a kind of a cutter out of high ball screen action. So he did that quite a bit, where he would kind of start with a high ball screen and then kind of bring that into a side handoff action and then cut to the basket, which worked out pretty well. And I think that's something that Minnesota could do. But the other thing you can do is if you have him at the top of the key, I mean, a Simmons and Karl Anthony Towns pick and roll, I mean, is up there for deadliest. And I mean, it might be the second hardest pick and roll to guard behind, you know, LeBron James and Anthony Davis in the entire league, just because Simmons is insane going downhill. And if you try and have a guy trail Simmons and then also have your big drop, I mean, then Cat's got a wide open three and it's one pass away to a guy like Russell or Beasley potentially for an even more open three. So just the possibilities with those two in the pick and roll are endless. And then the other thing that I saw Philadelphia do that I put in the article, and there's a clip in there of that, is they would use a guy like Korkmaz as a screener in an inverted ball screen, or kind of like a small screening a big, if you will. So Simmons has the ball at the top of the key. And what happens is he'll pass it to Horford or Embiid kind of at the elbow. And then have Korkmaz like kind of do like a screen up, kind of right at the nail there. And then Simmons dives to the basket. And if you have two guys that, you know, dive on Simmons when he's going to the basket, and you've got a wide open three for Korkmaz. And it's just something that's really, really tough to defend. And if Cat was the guy who had the ball at the elbow, I mean, you could have Cat, you know, just attack one-on-one from the elbow if nothing's there somehow, or just have him simply shoot over the defense. So just having Simmons in the offense, I think, would really unlock Cat more as a cutter and get more open looks for both him and D'Angelo Russell from deep.
Yeah, because I think that people, the stigma obviously with Simmons is that he can't shoot and he won't shoot. And I think that people would kind of imagine that if you put him with any team, including the Timberwolves, that he kind of ruins their spacing and that the three-point shooting, you know, goes to hell. But I think that with the Timberwolves, you know, restructured team after the trade deadline, there was a lot of shooting there. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think they were top five in both three-point attempts and three-point percentage.
Offensive rating and points per game, too.
Yeah, so, and obviously that was a, you know, 15-game, 14-game sample size, so it's not the be-all and end-all, but with that kind of shooting around Simmons, the problems that he brings with the lack of shooting and the refusal to launch threes really get mitigated a whole lot more, because not only can the players around him make up for the spacing and give him more space to drive, but they also hit those threes themselves. So not only are you unlocking these 3-point shooters, because Ben Simmons is obviously an amazing drive and kick player, just draws so much gravity in the paint and just has excellent vision at humongous size for a guy who's essentially a point guard. But also, that's drawing the defenders away from him, so there's more space for him to drive and not have to pass and be able to get into the lane and get around the rim and hit those shots. He has the little hook shots and the little kind of fadeaway jumper things that work for him as well, close to the rim. So I just, like we said, we're not saying that this is close, or it's there's definitely a long way for either team to go for this to become a deal, but I really, truly don't think that there's many better places than Minnesota to maximize Ben Simmons, and then there's not many players that maximize Karl Anthony Towns like Ben Simmons.
Yeah, I completely agree with just about every single thing you said. And something that I wanted to point out that you mentioned was that a lot of people say that he can't shoot, but the term that I would use would be that he won't shoot.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, his shot doesn't look that bad to me. Like, I don't, if you just stuck Ben Simmons out there and had him start shooting threes, like, I think he could probably shoot 30, in between the 30% and 34% from three.
Enough to at least respect. And I don't think it's slow. It's not like an Andre Drummond workout video, you know, when you see him shoot. Like, it looks like a jump shot from a wing or from a guard.
Yeah. And I mean, and the other thing too, I mean, if you think about a guy like Giannis, I mean, I think Ben Simmons' jumper looks a lot better than Giannis's does. And Giannis is trying to add that part to his game. So, but the other thing that I wanted to point out, and you mentioned it, that, you know, that you think that Ben would add a lot more than he would subtract from a team. And I completely agree with that, because there was something that I did, you know, I was doing some kind of statistical research, kind of down in the weeds. And so, If you look at all of the players in the NBA that played at least 1,400 minutes, which is the low end for a guy who's playing most of the season, and took at least 50% of their shots at the rim this past season, there are only 15 players in the league that did that. And almost all of them were centers, with the exception of Ben Simmons, OG Anunoby, and Giannis. And Ben Simmons was one of four players who shot at least 70% of their shots at the rim. The other three were centers, and Ben did that while having the second lowest percentage of assisted makes at the rim. So essentially, he's incredible at getting to the rim and taking good shots at the rim without needing somebody to pass to him inside.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was able to do that with such limited spacing in Philadelphia makes me think that his points per game would take a pretty big jump from the 16 that he averaged in Philly, or 18 or whatever it was, this past year, up into the mid 20s. I think that would happen pretty easily, just from him being more aggressive going downhill. And so it's really easy to see how he would fit in. And I don't think that a guy like Simmons would make it easier to guard a guy like Kat or to guard a guy like D'Lo. I think it would make it more difficult. Just because you'd have to honor them as passers a lot more than you have. Especially a lot more than you had to honor Kat last year, just considering that you had like Travion Graham and Andrew Wiggins shooting threes on the wing. But yeah, he would be a crazy unique weapon for the Timberwolves. And I think there's a path, at least a more clear one, to acquire him than there is to acquire a guy like Devin Booker. Especially now, considering that Daryl Morey is the president of basketball operations, and we know how close he and Gerson Rosas are, and they've already shown, you know, a willingness to deal with one another. So that's just something to monitor for sure. But definitely, like you said, something that is more unlikely than likely.
Well, two more things then, since you brought that up. First, I want, give me, you know, your rundown, or give me what you think would happen defensively. Like, obviously the offense is great. Minnesota are probably going to be pretty good on offense, but defense is the flavor of the month constantly, the flavor of the decade for Minnesota. So what do you think Simmons unlocks defensively for this team? Because he's obviously a great defender. We all know that. But like I said earlier, we don't all watch a whole lot of him or spend, you know, weeks breaking down film on him. So we don't know exactly why he's a great defender. So give me your thoughts on that, and then hit me with a structure, a deal, you know, some way that Minnesota, in your mind, could get this over the line if it were to become a reality.
Yeah. So when you look at just, you know, the defensively, when you look at Simmons, I mean, the place that you got to start is you got to start with just how uniquely huge and athletic that he is. Yeah. So he's 6'10". He's got a 7-foot wingspan. He's 240 pounds and he's lightning quick laterally. So he can come up and get physical with you because he knows that he's athletic enough to stay with you laterally. So there are often times where he would guard other ones or, you know, main ball handlers. So one that I watched was I was watching a game when they played Bradley Beal. And, you know, most guys, when you're guarding Bradley Beal, you probably give him a little bit of space because, you know, him taking a jump shot is probably a win over, you know, him getting into the lane and making something happen. But you see a guy like Ben Simmons just goes up and attacks him and takes space from him and dares guys to try and, you know, pull a dribble move to get past him. And if that happens, you know, he's so good with timing in his hands, guarding on the ball that he can very easily at least poke the ball away or get a steal, or just make timely reaches, to just disrupt the rhythm of the offensive player. So that's one thing that I noticed. When he's playing off the ball, he does a really good job of knowing kind of who the guy he's guarding is and knows when to take risks. And so, you know, there'd be times where, you know, a guy's driving or he's guarding a guy, you know, above the break on a three and there's a big kind of waiting for a handoff and he just comes up, sneaks behind the big, takes the ball and goes and runs down and dunks it. So he's very smart in terms of knowing who has the ball and when to take risks. But then too, you know, he's just really, really good in terms of understanding spacing on the defensive end of the floor. So he knows kind of where to position himself on drives or in the PNR, you know, digging. He's also very, very good with tagging roll men. And so those two things I think would be really important, especially if you've got a guy like D'Angelo Russell at the point of attack guarding other ones. You know, you could use D'Lo to guard ones and kind of steer guys into Simmons or Towns, or you could just throw Simmons right there at the top of the key and just blow stuff up. But the other thing that I think would be really interesting would be if you played a zone and you played more of an aggressive zone with Simmons and Okogie, you know, at kind of the top of the key, or if you played like a 1-2-2 kind of a trapping zone and you had Culver on one side and Russell on the other, just because those guys have, you know, really long arms and you could trap with Simmons and those guys. I think it would just unlock more looks that you can throw at a team defensively and kind of junk up a game, which I think is important, especially if you want to get in the playoffs. You got to be able to junk games up and throw different looks at different offenses.
Yeah, yeah. And I think coming from someone who's been watching Jaden McDaniels' film for the last few weeks, I think it's a lot easier to hide susceptible one-on-one defenders in the corners of those kind of 2-3 zones. And I think you could definitely do that with the Russell, because or you obviously still have to play kind of between two players, but you never really get into a one-on-one situation or a pick-and-roll situation. Like, you're always kind of the floater on the side of that zone. And if you could have Culver or Okogie and then Simmons at the top of a zone and then kind of hide Russell in the corner, that's probably the best way to hide him on defense. And they obviously tried that last year just with the man-to-man defense. Like, they tried to hide Russell as much as possible and get Okogie as the point of attack defender. But yeah, I think the zone is actually a really good way to hide guys who are kind of susceptible one-on-one.
Right.
But obviously that gets a bit harder because you need to funnel them in that kind of zone into a strong rim defender, and Towns hasn't proven to be that. But if you have Simmons out there, it gets a lot easier if the point of attack guy or the guy who's at the top of the key can really hang with their guy.
And I think length matters a lot more when you're playing a zone. So, like,
yeah,
Russell, I think, wouldn't be your typical, excuse me, I got to hide this guy in a zone guy, just because most of those guys are someone like Trae Young or Steph Curry, where you know, they're 6'2 or 6'3 and they have a 6'5 or 6'6 wingspan at best, whereas Russell's 6'5 and he's got a 6'10 wingspan. So that would be interesting. And then Cat, I mean, Cat's got a 7'4 wingspan. So those are, I don't want to say it like almost becomes an asset to have, but I think being able to play long lineups, especially if you had a guy like Simmons, would be really just a total game changer for the defense. And kind of going back to the whole Washington thing too, I mean, if the Timberwolves play zone more and his game has improved enough to a point where, you know, you can trust him out there. And we see some of the shooting that he had last year in the G League. I mean, what did he shoot last year? 45% in the G League, Jalen Noel?
On like 7 or 8 3-point attempts.
Yeah,
game.
I mean,
like,
if any of that is able to translate to the NBA next season, I think you could see a lot more Jalen Noel, just because, you know, he played at Washington and he wasn't defensive player of the year, but he was, I think he was on the all defense team at Washington.
They were really good even this year.
And they play zone all the time.
Yeah, all the time, no matter what. And I think they played one game man on man for maybe half the game, and I watched 15-16 of their games, and they play zone 100% of the time. And they're, for a team that struggled overall, they're still a pretty good defensive team, especially with, like you said, the length. Like, McDaniels is obviously like a freak of nature athletically and work lengthwise, and then Isaiah Stewart is a big dude as well, kind of in that Towns mold where he's quite good right at the rim, but making decisions anywhere apart from that, he was pretty bad. So I think it kind of works well. Obviously, McDaniels isn't comparable to D'Angelo Russell in terms of size, but they did try and keep McDaniels in the corners so that he could just use that length. And the strength deficiencies and stuff that McDaniels have don't get put on show, because he never really had to guard one on one at all. Like, I could not clip one, you know, video from all the games I watched of McDaniels playing a single bit of one on one defense. Like, that's how much they kind of hid him in that zone or kind of just played to his strengths in that zone.
Yeah, he's a guy too where, I mean, he was a consensus top five recruit for the class of 2019. And I mean, everybody thought that he was going to be a lottery pick before the season started. And so he's a guy where I think if he's around at 33, I think you take a good, hard, long look at it. And maybe there's maybe like a Tyler Bay is there. And you take him, but I mean, he's a guy where I would trade back into the second round to go get, for sure. I mean, or if a pick comes around where like someone wants to trade down, or you can trade down out of 17 and, you know, and maybe get like a late first, maybe the Knicks want to trade back up. They've got like 27. And that gives you maybe you trade like 17 and, I don't know, and Culver next year for like a pick for like the Knicks first next year, or the Dallas pick that they have next year, could be something interesting, just to get another really high ceiling guy like McDaniels. You know, he's got a lot of personality and attitude things to work out, but if that stuff panned out, I mean, I think you could end up getting a huge, huge steal. And again, just goes back to the whole would enable you to play zone more, which I think we're going to see more and more and more of, from NBA teams moving forward.
Yeah, so before we get into that, I know that I mentioned it, and I'm sure that people want to know, because you are the trade expert, the free agency expert. You're my point of reference on all that stuff. So is there anything you have in mind that you think Minnesota could get Ben Simmons, or do you think it's just that unlikely that nothing they have right now will be able to get them over the line?
So I think that they do in terms of, you know, number one, Beasley, Culver, you know, the Brooklyn first. Like, I think they have enough where, you know, they can at least get in the door with a conversation. I do think that a two-team trade is rather unlikely.
Yeah.
And I think that they would need a third team to do it. But a couple that I laid out were, you know, this first idea, it'll be the second idea that I have in the article. But it's something where the Timberwolves would get someone like Ben Simmons, And then you'd use the Thunder to help you out. So you'd send Dennis Schroeder to the 76ers, Malik Beasley to the 76ers, in a sign and trade, and then you'd send the number one pick to Philly as well. And then Danilo Gallinari would come in a sign and trade. So that's what Philly would get. And then I also want to note that number one pick. So I sent Bobby Marks a DM asking him if a team theoretically could draft somebody at number one and then just not sign him and wait until the free agency window opens and then do a sign and trade and package Malik Beasley with a new contract. And then like the rights to like LaMelo Ball, which, yeah. And that's entirely possible. So that could happen. So in this case, Philly would pick, you know, whoever they want at number one. And then you'd just sit on that and then send that out.
Which I don't think has ever been done before, though, has it? Like, I can't remember a scenario where that ever actually happened, though.
Yeah, and part of the reason why that's able to happen right now is because of this whole COVID schedule. Yeah. And so the thing there is that, you know, since Ball wouldn't sign a contract, his salary doesn't count there. But the way it works is you get Oklahoma City in here. So then you'd send Oklahoma City, Al Horford, Jarrett Culver, 17 from Brooklyn, and then the 38th overall pick from Philadelphia. And then Timberwolves own a pick swap with either Philadelphia or Denver in 2022 for their second round pick. So whoever second round pick is more favorable there, either Philadelphia or Denver's, would then get sent to Oklahoma City. And then the Timberwolves would also send a 2023 first, which would be unprotected. And the nice thing too is like getting a guy like Schroeder, like I think Schroeder could be a really good backup point guard for them. You know, he's on a 1 year, $15.5 million deal for this upcoming year, but I could see them re-signing him at a much cheaper rate. And then also getting you know, two really good shooters in Beasley and Gallinari, I mean, automatically helps them stretch the floor there. And then if you get a guy like Ball and LaMelo pans out, I mean, that could be a really, really dangerous team, you know, this upcoming season and the season after that. So that was probably the most likely, you know, trade scenario that I could come up with before the season starts. But I think it'd be far more likely that that he would get dealt at the trade deadline this upcoming season rather than getting dealt before the season. Just because I think Daryl will want to see that through and see what he has. But another one that I would look out for is potentially getting the Wizards involved and sending Bradley Beal to the 76ers and then sending kind of the Wizards everything that you would have sent the Sixers. I think that's an interesting idea as well. And I laid out a scenario in the article with that one as well.
Yeah, so like you just mentioned, I think that the more realistic path here is that the Timberwolves make those incremental moves to try to gather pieces and gather assets, and then at the trade deadline or even, you know, after next season when we're kind of trade talks are heating up a little bit, that Simmons is more likely to come. And I think for me the obvious move here is it comes on draft night. I mean, you obviously have three picks. I think there's genuine motivation to move the first overall pick, as we all probably know by now, and bring back some assets there that can be flipped again down the line or just implemented into the system and potentially thrive like Malik Beasley did in the trade with Denver. I do think there's other avenues in the draft. I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, if they packaged 17 and 33 and moved up in the draft, which is kind of zigging where everyone else is zagging. And if you could get a deal kind of with a team like the Spurs at 11, who obviously trust their scouting department very much, the Spurs, who have had so much success with guys in the late 20s and in the second round over their huge stretch of success. I think that's, if you got someone at 11, if you picked at 1 and 11, that gives you two really good assets down the line, assuming that they kind of continue the trajectory that either Anthony Edwards or LaMelo Ball and then someone like Tyrese Maxey or I'm not sure off the top of my head, who, you know, Devin Vassell could slip to 11, like guys like that. You know, if you get two top, you know, two lottery picks, then in a year, that's two really good assets, both on good contracts that you can kind of add into the mix there, or at the trade deadline, you know, you could move both of those guys with a James Johnson or one of those guys and Jarrett Culver, something like that. Like, I think just with those draft assets, plus a trade chip like James Johnson, I think you can start to put together the basis of a really intriguing, you know, trade package. And I think everyone wants that player, that third star, that Ben Simmons, that Devin Booker. I think they want that immediately, but it's about building toward it and finding the right pieces through the draft, through the free agency, through some minor trades like that Malik Beasley trade was, where it kind of didn't seem very significant at the time, but now it seems a bit better, you know, now that Malik Beasley's averaged 20 a game or whatever for 15 games. So yeah, I think just adding valuable assets that you can shift around later is the key to getting someone like Simmons, because I just don't think they have that blue collar trade chip right now, you know, unless apart from the number one pick, but I think the number one pick is on a nice edge, because it could be more valuable now if LaMelo Ball or Anthony Edwards enter the league and, you know, they're crap, and this time next year their value's tanked, or they could enter the league and be way better than we kind of think they are, because most of us have pretty, not low hopes, but everyone knows that the top of this draft is fairly weak. So if they come in and overachieve, you've got an even better asset at the trade deadline or going into next offseason.
Yeah, and so there's really three risks you run with doing that. The first being that, Malik Beasley just isn't able to replicate the performance that he had after arriving in Minnesota. So that's number one. And then number two, obviously, would be, you know, Ball or Edwards or Wiseman or whoever it is, just not playing well at all. And
that's very possible.
Yeah, it is very possible. And I think that then the byproduct of if that player isn't playing very well, I mean, the Timberwolves probably aren't going to win a ton of games. I think they'll win more games just with offense, and to a point where I think they might get a little closer to 500 rather than I think they'd be closer to 500 than they would to being the worst team in the league. But I mean, then you start to invite the risk of, you know, Towns really starting to get upset, just with continually losing again. And so, I mean, that's just another thing to think about. And then kind of backtracking to the draft, I think you said trading up. I think trading up is a lot more likely if the Timberwolves don't trade down. Like, trading up with 17 is a lot more likely if the Timberwolves do not trade down from number one.
Yeah, that's my thoughts as well. I mean, if they pick at one, I can imagine them not wanting to use 17 and 33. And if you can't, you know, get someone with 17, like with James Johnson plus 17 or a deal like that, I think packaging both those picks together and just trying to move up 5, 6, 7 spots gets you a guy that you really want rather than someone who kind of falls to you because the other guys are already gone.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it could be a guy, and yeah, like you mentioned, I mean, it could be Vassell if he drops, or, you know, maybe you move up to go get, like, if a Williams slips, I don't know why he would. Like, I think he's probably going to be a top 10 pick. But you know, those are two guys where I think you have it in there in case a guy slips. And then, you know, if not, maybe you go target a Maxi, or, you know, maybe Desmond Bane is there and you're worried about him getting taken. I mean, there's plenty of guys that you can go grab, or maybe like a Kyra Lewis Jr. I think that would be sweet. But
and that's someone right in that range that I said, like 11 with Spurs, you know, or 10. Like, you get a Lewis, you get a Pat Williams, a Devin Vassell. Like, all those, someone's going to slip in this draft. It's just so unpredictable. And, like, you know, every report you hear and everyone I talk to, they've kind of got different intel from different teams, so someone's going to slip. And if you use 17 and 33, maybe you can be the one team that zigs when everyone else zags, and everyone else is trying to move down, and you move up and you sneak someone that ends up really good.
Yeah, and I think whomever they would take at an 11 or something like that, like, it's got to be somebody that they can play right away. because they would know that they'd have to maximize that player's trade value, especially if you're swinging for a guy like Simmons. I think that's the play if you're swinging for a super uber star like Simmons or Booker. But if you're going for a guy like an Aaron Gordon, I think obviously your strategy would have to be a little bit different.
I think if it's an Aaron Gordon or a Victor Oladipo or someone like that, I think you kind of just, you try and get them on the cheap, and if you can't, then you just forget about it and you just move on to the next target and wait for the next big name to ask out, because I don't think you can afford to pay overs for Oladipo or for Gordon. Like if you can get them for 17 and Culver, like I'm taking that deal for either of those guys, even, you know, 17, 33 and Culver probably for Oladipo, because I'm still an Oladipo believer. But you don't trade the number one pick for either of these guys. That's bad asset management.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing that I think will happen is I think the Timberwolves have done a good job of asset management so far. You know, I think that Malik Beasley trade kind of was a perfect example of that. And you know, no matter how complex one of these deals might end up being, I really do think that this front office is well equipped with the right people to make that work and maximize that path.
Yeah, if there's ever a guy who can do it, it's Sachin Gupta. Like, you know, and hearing him speak in the press conferences and stuff, like, that's one smart dude. And someone, I think it got posted, I think Kyle posted on the Tana Supers account and a few other guys posted it. Like, that's just a dude who loves his job. And,
oh, yeah.
And really, you know, thrives on making intricate deals happen and knowing every square millimeter of the CBA and stuff like that. So I think, like you said, like you're very good at coming up with deals that I kind of agree with, because I thought that there was no deal that I would think, yeah, that's possible to do with Simmons. But that one you said before, like if the Sixers get back Beasley, the number one pick, and Gallo, they're a really good team. Like, they're 55 wins at least again. Like, that's the kind of team you do build around Joel Embiid and obviously Schroeder as well. So it's just, yeah, like there's paths there.
Yeah, and you know, if you put a gun to my head and made me choose who I think, you know, Philly would build around, I would think it would be Embiid. Just because I think you saw in the playoffs this year, you know, as much as we want to say it's a guard driven league, and that's not necessarily a false statement, but having a big guy that you can go to score, but also to, you know, run your offense through and make plays, I think is a real luxury. And I think it wouldn't surprise me at all if they saw Simmons as a more valuable guy to kind of raising their ceiling than Simmons.
And I think there's something to be said about having a franchise player personality, even if it's not completely up to par with the franchise player game. Like, I think that in a vacuum, Simmons is a more versatile, he's a more scalable player as a franchise player, and someone who can really fit with a lot of talent. You know, like, you can put a lot of players around Simmons and have a really good team, I think, more than Embiid. But Embiid really has that superstar personality, that superstar gravity with the fan base, with, you know, on the court, the big games he can have. I don't think Simmons is necessarily got that first option mentality where he kind of can embrace a whole town and a whole city and a whole team. And drag them along. And I think Embiid's personality is at times bigger than his game, but he's obviously a fantastic player. And I think these things matter to front offices. Optics matter to front offices, especially a new one, partially new one in Philadelphia. And I don't think the first thing they'd want to do is trade Embiid, who is someone who the fans adore and who has really captured the hearts and imagination of Philadelphia.
Yeah,
more than Simmons, anyway.
Yeah, and when you think of the Sixers, I mean, you think of Embiid.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I completely agree with that. And yeah, I think it just kind of goes along with why I think Simmons and Minnesota are a perfect match, because, you know, Simmons can kind of, you know, be that kind of quiet guy and lead, and not have to be the face of everything like Cat has the, you know, the opportunity to do. And Simmons can just kind of fit right in and be in an environment where his game, I think, is much better, a system that much better suits his game than what is currently there in Philly.
Yeah. So is there any kind of incremental moves that you see on the horizon or a player that you see Minnesota targeting, I guess, this offseason that gets you closer to a deal for a Simmons or a Beal or a Booker down the line?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, that, you know, since the last time we've talked, the fact that Minnesota's kind of created some type of leveraging wedge with Golden State and Charlotte, now that, you know, it's kind of come out that the guy that those two teams want is Wiseman. Yeah. And the monkey wrench that gets thrown into that now is that Wiseman, you know, apparently wants nothing to do with Minnesota and doesn't want to play here, doesn't want to be here because of Cat, which is understandable. And some would think that would probably hurt the trade value of the number one pick, just because I think a team like Golden State could for sure call Minnesota's bluff and be like, I dare you to take Wiseman and see what happens.
Yeah.
But I think too that Charlotte, I mean, Charlotte knows what Golden State wants, and I think there's probably a sense of urgency for them to really get their guy because they're so close to the number one pick.
Yeah, they want to leapfrog. They want to leapfrog Golden State and not give them the chance. They don't want to call Golden State's bluff like Golden State would be willing to call Minnesota's, because Golden State have a very good chance to just take Wiseman. And if that's the guy they're, you know, enamored with, they're in love with, like, Minnesota's the obvious candidate there to leapfrog then and just give no one else a chance to take your guy.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first deal that I kind of have in mind is you go to Charlotte and you say, all right, you know, obviously we'll take the third pick. And then you can either give us PJ Washington or your first round pick next year. Yeah. And I think Charlotte, I mean, if Charlotte really wants to play with fire, I think they would do that. You know, I think that they'd probably rather give up a guy like PJ Washington than a guy like Miles Bridges. But I think if you're dealing with Charlotte, there's a damn good chance that you get out of that either their first round pick next year, which obviously you'd probably have some protections on it, but I mean, still, that'd be a really good first round pick next year. And then obviously a really strong young guy in PJ Washington or a versatile defender and hyper athletic guy and Miles Bridges. So like one of those three assets in addition to the number three pick, I think, is the best place to start, because then depending how the chips fall, you know, let's say Wiseman goes one and the Warriors aren't able to trade number two or stir up enough trade value. Let's say they take, I don't know, maybe like an Okoro number two. Or someone like that, just because I don't think that they're going to take Wiseman, or I don't think they would take Ball or Edwards there. So let's say that they end up picking and they take a guy like Isaac Okoro at two, which, you know, may not be the best kind of like use of the asset, I guess. But and then Minnesota's sitting at three and LaMelo Ball and Anthony Edwards are still on the board. And those have kind of been the guys who everybody expected to be competing for the number one pick. You know, Chicago's sitting there at four, and that's a team that I think LaVar Ball has mentioned that LaMelo would be good. I think the two teams that he mentioned this week were Detroit and Chicago. And so I think you could almost start another bidding war and trade back again, and get a team like either Chicago to move up a spot or Detroit or New York to move up from seven or eight, respectively.
And then you've come into draft night and got two extra, assuming that Chicago or Detroit or whoever will give you an asset on top of the pick. Then you come in, you've got two assets and still a pick in the top 10.
Which I think would be highway robbery.
There shouldn't be a single Timberwolves fan that wouldn't leave that scenario absolutely thrilled.
Yeah, and then I think because it also gives you the opportunity then to just kind of sit on those assets and go next year or this upcoming season and then just kind of see what happens with those and then make those trades. So I think there's a world in which, you know, you could potentially get Wendell Carter from the Bulls for them to move up one spot. Or, you know, maybe take a risk and try and get, you know, another center, like a guy like Daniel Gafford from Chicago. So those are two names that kind of come to mind. I don't think that they would part with Lauri Markkanen. But Wendell Carter is kind of the guy that I would think about just because, you know, I think they could be lower on him. His salary is a little bit lower. He's more of a defensive-minded guy, which I think the Timberwolves need. And then if you're looking at New York, I think the guy that stands out to me is Frankie Smokes, just because he's a pit bull defender at the one spot. And if he's able to shoot it any better than he's been able to, he could be that kind of number two point guard that the team has really been looking for. And I would be fine just taking Frank Ntilikina and 8 for them to move up 5 spots. I mean, maybe they give us, you know, 27 or whatever it is they have this year. Is it 27? Yeah, it's 27. 27 for the Clippers for Marcus Morris. So you could take 27 from them. You could then maybe say that we want the Dallas pick next year. So there's a lot of different things. I mean, and then if you think about the Pistons, you know, maybe it's Luke Kennard or maybe it's Derrick Rose. You bring Derrick Rose back. Like that would certainly be an interesting one. Or a guy like Svi Mykhailiuk, a nice shooter or Bruce Brown. I mean, there's a lot of guys in Detroit that I think you can make that work with. So, but like what if you were kind of going into draft night, with the situation that the Timberwolves are kind of placed in, what do you think you're like, what are your priorities on draft night, or kind of what, if you were running the team, kind of how would you play out draft night? What's in the back of your mind, or what's your end goal going into draft?
Yeah. I think the first one is that you try and, like, I think you're definitely going to try and trade down, right? So I think you want to try and bring back a future pick, preferably next year where you don't have a pick and the draft at the moment is looking really strong. I mean, it looked really strong 2 years ago, this draft class that we're in now. So you can never, you know, count all your chickens there. But I think that, yeah, the priority is that you want to get an unprotected pick for next year from a team like Detroit or New York or something. That's probably not going to happen. And then I think it gets to the point where
it could from Detroit, just because Detroit has Dallas's pick next year.
Yeah. So I think that if you can get something like that, then that's probably the and you want a real asset next to that as well. Like you want a Frank Ntilikina, who I'm not overly high on, but I do agree with you that he could be a really good backup point guard and, you know, a genuine rotation piece. Or you want Dembuya or someone like that. Like, you want something tangible. You're gonna ask pretty high because you're not giving away this pick. And even though the value's certainly not as high as it usually is in a draft, it's definitely still holding value. I think that you probably exhaust those options and you don't get really anywhere, because I think a lot of teams will be pretty hesitant to move an asset and then a future asset for the top pick, when I think a lot of teams are probably pretty, like, teams in that 5 or 4 to 10 range are probably pretty comfortable just picking Isaac Okoro or picking Devin Vassell or Killian Hayes. Like, I think a lot of teams could convince themselves that, like, those guys will be better than LaMelo Ball, have less, you know, bust potential than Ball or Edwards.
Yeah.
So then you might just try and put all your eggs in one basket, and that basket being this year. I think then you go to Atlanta and you say, give us Kevin Huerter and give us pick 6 for number 1.
Do you think they want to move up, though?
I think that they could convince them. I think it depends on what Trey wants. I think if Trey, who by all reports is really close with Anthony Edwards, like, I think if he says, Get Anthony Edwards. As another guy who can take the scoring load off me, because obviously, like, Hurd is a good scorer, John Collins is a good scorer, but none of them really take the ball out of Trae Young's hands on the perimeter or stop him from, you know, getting double teamed every night and having to score 35 for them to win. Anthony Edwards does do that, I think, and, you know, Georgia native, friends with Trae Young. I honestly think that like a Herder and number six is one of the most likely deals. And I think then you're just trying to build that core this year. You get Herder, you put some faith in him, then you can put a legitimate cap on how much you pay Malik Beasley, because he becomes a little bit more redundant. Like, you don't need to pay him $15 million anymore. Like, if he wants, you know, 4 years, $60 million, you just let him go and take Herder.
I don't think he, especially considering now, you know, what came out of the legal situation, I don't think there's any team in the league that would offer him 4 years for $60 million.
Yeah, so then I think in that same strategy, that's the one where you deal with Chicago as well. You take four and Carter Jr. for one, and, you know, you don't ask for any more assets. You put your faith in Carter Jr. that he can be your starting power forward next to Towns. And then you either try and move up from 17-33, like we said before, like package those together and get up into the early teens, or you just take someone at 17-33 and then you kind of just figure it out from there, try and get someone, you know, a Christian Wood or someone in free agency that can be a long-term piece, and you just, you know, give it a shot next year and hope that you don't, you know, come 11th, which they probably will anyway. But I think, you know, like, I just think I think it's a tough spot. I think, and then the third option is you just take Anthony Edwards or take LaMelo Ball and hope to God that they become good.
Yeah, I think that the unfortunate thing is that you're just kind of playing with fire no matter which path you go down.
Yeah. There's so many avenues for Gerson Roses to get fired in 3 years because of this draft. Like, you trade down and you get Isaac Okoro and he never learns how to shoot and he, you know, is nothing more than kind of a taller Josh Okogie, which we both don't think he will be, but, you know, that's something that could happen. And then Anthony Edwards ends up a five-time All-Star. you lose your job. Or you take Anthony Edwards and at number one, and Isaac Okoro ends up a five-time All-Star, and Anthony Edwards is, you know, Andrew Wiggins 2.0, but even smaller. Right. And then you get fired. Like, he's definitely, like you said, he's playing with fire, and he has no choice but to just play with that fire.
Oh yeah, which is unfortunate. But I think, you know, he's a guy who I think externally seems very confident in the plan that they have and what they have in front of them. I mean, obviously, no front office is going to be like, you know what, we don't feel that great about where we're at. Like, no one's going to say that. Yeah. But watching some of that media availability from Sutchin, I think, just showed how like eager they are to attack this and how excited they are at the prospect of just having this kind of ringer in front of them. That they got to go through to kind of get to where they want to be. I think it makes it fun for them, and I think makes me feel a little bit better knowing that they're like ready to attack this and you know want to make the best of it. But you know, I think it's going to be interesting what happens if somehow they're unable to get out of number one.
I think that they know that that's definitely an option. Like, I don't think they're going to throw the pick away just because everyone thinks that Minnesota should trade down. Like, I think if they don't get real assets, if they don't think that the asset they're getting in return is more valuable than Anthony Edwards or than LaMelo Ball, then they'll just pick the guy. And like,
who
we
do
said,
you think
like,
that would be?
I think it would be Edwards.
I agree.
I think there's a lot of things that I don't believe, you know, in the media right now, obviously, like a lot of smoke screens. But one thing I do believe is that LaMelo Ball probably isn't doing very well in interviews. Every interview I've seen from him, every, you know, the Mike Schmitz breakdown, like, he seems to really struggle in front, you know, in a personality wise, and it's not a it's not in a LeVar Ball way. It's more of a, I think his whole game is based on instinct. And I think when people ask him to explain his game or to explain things in depth, it's just not there for him. And that's, you know, that's good and bad because, like, this is a kid who just plays without, I don't want to say without knowing what he's doing, because obviously, you know, he knows he's been playing basketball all his life. But when you hear him talk about his game, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say he's played a lot of unstructured basketball.
Yeah, exactly. And he's just, like, it's just pure instinct for him. Like, you know, in those Smith's breakdowns, like, he says, like, what went on here? And every answer is just like, oh, well, I saw the pass and I did it. Like, he's not going to break down a play for you. He doesn't seem to really be that kind of point guard. Like, he's not that Chris Paul point guard where he knows every play in the playbook and every play in the other team's playbook. Like, he's just the guy who's just going out there and playing ball. I can see him dropping just because the teams that were already, I guess, teetering on the edge of whether he was the right pick or not, lose a little bit of confidence in his ability to learn and to grow in a team structure, just because, as you said, like, he's just played unstructured basketball for his whole life. He's never been asked to play defense before this year in Australia, and even then, like, it was so obvious.
It was more showtime than anything else.
Yeah, even then, he was still given the keys to the offense and never, you know, hooked out of the game for shooting a 30-footer with 17 seconds on the shot clock or something. So, I think teams who are on edge about him, which I think Minnesota would be one, obviously, because they have so many options. And I think if they're choosing between Edwards and Ball, I think Edwards is the more scalable prospect. Like, you can just drop Edwards in, you know what I mean, and kind of tell him to get him where he fits in. But with Ball, you really need to structure a team around Ball, and then he could be really good. But with Towns and Russell, like, can you afford to structure your team around a rookie? Probably not.
Yeah, you know, I don't think you really can, especially if you're gonna, you know, especially if you've, you know, you're putting Cat first and you also want to make the playoffs. Like, I just don't know how you can structure. I just don't know how you can structure your team around that. And, you know, I think the interview process is going to be important because, you know, I think people kind of question Ball's drive and Edwards's drive and kind of everything that comes with that. But Anthony Edwards is, I think he's more of a competitor than Ball is. And I think that I trust Anthony Edwards' development a lot more than I trust LaMelo Ball's development, just because of the people that we've seen them to be. But, you know, it'll be really interesting, and I'm glad that we agree on the you know, if you had to plant your flag and take a guy, who would you pick? Just because it's not a glamorous situation to be in, for sure.
I think we've said to each other before, like, both of these guys are probably going to be pretty bad next season. And I think it's important for Timberwolves fans, if Ball or Russell do end up on this team, that you have to give them a bit of time. And that doesn't mean that, you know, you can't criticize them or you can't have your reservations about them. But, like, these aren't Zion Williamsons. They're not Karl Anthony Towns. Like, they're guys who are going to come in and probably struggle. Like, Anthony Edwards is probably going to shoot 40% from the field, but he's probably going to have nights where he scores 30. You know what I mean? Like, and he's going to have nights where he scores nothing. Like, that's the kind of player he is right now. It's not going to magically change because, you know, he's gone up a level. Like, he's not going to get any better. And LaMelo Ball is going to have nights where he can't hit a shot, where he can't hit a three, where the passing doesn't do enough to make him a positive on the court. But I think you have to give both of these guys time, and I think that's the problem. You know, that's the crux of this, is that even if you take them as an asset and you want to move them in a year, like, they're not, the likelihood is they're not going to blow up in the next 12 months and become a crazy valuable asset compared to what they are now, just because they're going to struggle in their rookie season. They're both guys who need a lot of development, but the potential is what catches the eye and what has them as the consensus top two picks. So it's a tough one.
What would you put the chances of either of them improving kind of their position as an asset? Like, what would you put the chances of that at?
Who do you think would
have a better chance of becoming a more positive asset than he is right now?
I think it's Ball, to be honest, because I think they're both going to struggle with their shooting percentages and with their efficiency, but I have more faith that Edwards will become more efficient and become a good scorer, but I think from day dot, Ball is going to be able to do other things which take your eye away from the fact that he's shooting, you know, 38% from the field and 25% from three. Like, everyone knows and everyone harps on about it, but he's a truly elite floor general. And he rebounds, and I think he'll have decent, like, steal numbers. I don't think he'll be a good defender, but I think, like, if you box score browsing, which we both know isn't the way to evaluate players, but, you know, that's how you get hyped up. You know, if you're averaging 12, 8 and 8 compared to Edwards's, you know, 14, 3 and 3, I think that kind of is the basis of skyrocketing your value. So I wouldn't wager either guy will have a better value, but my pick would be Ball, because I think from day dot he has an elite talent that at least he'll be able to show straight away, rather than just looking at it and thinking he'll be able to do this in the future, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. And I also think that, you know, based on where we're at, like, there might be teams who are lower on him now to begin with, so there's more kind of, like, room for him to climb.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, kind of more rungs on the ladder for him to climb, which I think could be interesting. Plus, I just think that there's more of an unknown with him than there is with Edwards in terms of how their games will translate, just because I think evaluating a guy playing in the Australian League or the NBL is much more difficult in terms of their, you know, translation to the NBA than there is, you know, going from college basketball, especially to high major school like Georgia. But yeah, it'll just be an interesting situation to monitor, and one where, you know, for better or worse, you know, I trust the Timberwolves front office to make the right move in terms of positioning themselves in the best possible way to get a star, just because I think that's the way that's the ultimate goal out of this draft in this offseason. Just because I think they understand the prospect of, you know, it's much harder to build a consistent winner in a small market, and it's almost impossible to win a championship in a small market unless you have an insane amount of star power. And I think obviously that just has to start with consistently making the playoffs. But I think, you know, if you're able to go get a third star, that becomes a much more manageable task, and it's much easier to separate yourself from the New Orleans or the San Antonio or the Sacramento, or the Memphis in the Western Conference, because it's going to be you competing against all those teams for that last spot, potentially. So,
yeah. On that note, do you think kind of at 17 or 33, like, let's play hypothetical and say that they keep both of those picks, and even if they, you know, like, forgetting what they do with the number one pick, if they keep both of those picks, do you think that they will swing on a guy who's kind of high potential and maybe not so ready right now? Or do you think like a Jaden McDaniels or someone along those lines? Or do you think they will try and play it safe with those two picks and maybe get two guys who can slot into the rotation straight away, like a Sadiq Bey or a Desmond Bane or someone like that?
So I obviously think that they would try and go for Bane, just because I think his shooting would be the most alluring to them. But when it comes to Bay versus McDaniels, I think it depends on where you're at. Like, if you're at 33, I think you'd probably take Bay, just because I think Bay is more useful to you right away. But if you don't,
do you think that they're not going to take a guy who's going to be in the G League for 2 years, but who could end up, you know, as a third option rather than a guy who's probably going to play 15 minutes at least straight away, but might never be more than than, you know, your fifth starter.
I think it depends on how confident the Wolves feel in the rotation, to be honest with you, just because I think that they do feel pressure to win this season in some capacity. Like, I don't think they need to go win 50 games, but I do think they need to win 35 or 40 games.
And I think to do that, if you're not going to get Simmons or Booker or Beal, I think to do that, you need to have depth. Like, you need to be able to...
Yep.
You can't have massive drop-offs when Karl Anthony Towns isn't on the floor. So, you need depth. If you want to win 40 games, you need to have a team rather than Towns and some other guys.
Yeah, and I think that there's a really strong argument that can be made either way on that. Because... You know, on one hand, you need to win so Kat doesn't get pissed off and leave. But on the other hand, like, if you take Jaden McDaniels at 33 and you go stick him in the G League and he just balls out in the G League and you got guys like him and Jared Vanderbilt, chances are you're not going to trade both of them in a deal. But, I mean, both of those guys were really, really highly touted high school prospects that didn't have great first seasons just because either of injuries or... you know, foul trouble or whatever it may be, they just didn't have the freshman seasons you thought. And so taking them in the second round, I think makes a lot of sense just because I think the potential is still there with them. It's just a matter of...
I think Jaden McDaniels at his best is a really, really good player. I also don't have a lot of faith that he hits that peak, but I think that even if you turn him into a rotation player, like players who can do what he... does at 6'10", 7 foot wingspan, like long as hell, can run pick and roll, can shoot off the dribble, great shot blocker around the rim. Like, I think if you can hone that and harness all the goodness inside McDaniels and kind of expel some of the badness, then he would be a great pick at 33. But like you said, like, you also need guys to help you win now, and that's your Tyler Bay, that's your Desmond Bain, that's, you know, Trey Jones, like guys like that. They help straight away, and maybe that's the key to keeping Karl Anthony Towns is getting guys who can give you 5 extra wins in a season.
Yeah, and you know where they stake their flag on that, I think, could also have a lot to do with, you know, what they feel about the free agency class as well. So
yeah. So is there anyone? I mean, I want to get into schematic changes, but we're kind of running out of time. But is there any guys, I guess, that stand out to you as free agents? Like, would you take the same approach in free agency? Would you be going for guys who you think can improve you long-term or guys who are going to give you 5 extra wins next season? Or do you think that all depends on what you do on draft night as well?
I think it depends on what you do on draft night. But I think, you know, you've got to have a plan for both, obviously. So I think that it makes more sense to go for kind of a higher... I think it makes more sense to kind of go for like a higher... ceiling guy in the draft just because we haven't seen them in the NBA, whereas like a free agent, you know, on some level we've seen them play in the NBA, so we know what they're like. But I don't know. I mean I think too it all depends on who's there at 33, or if the Timberwolves trade down from 17.
And they don't have a lot of roster spots. I think that's the one of the most intriguing things in this offseason is like their roster's pretty much full at the moment. Like, someone's going to get waived. Like, I don't know if it's going to be Noel. I don't know if they're just, you know, going to put the, like, not, you know, sign the 33 to a two-way deal or, you know, like, there's I think they have 14, 15 players on their roster right now already. So, is Vanderbilt going to get crunched out? Like, it's hard to see them picking 3 times, like, with the roster they have right now.
Yeah, I mean, the only scenario in which I see that happening is if, you know, they're just swinging for the fences with a 3rd pick.
I think you can probably guarantee that Spellman goes, and I think Jacob Evans gets waived as well, especially if they pick 3 times, because those two seems to be really on the outer in this rotation and kind of just guys who never figure to play or to be a part of the future.
For sure.
So is there anyone, just before we go, is there anyone that straight away, like, you know, I know we're at least a few weeks away from it, but is there anyone in free agency that you've kind of got your heart set on already? With the mid-level, of course.
You know, not really. I mean, Derek Jones Jr. is a guy who I think would be really interesting. As a fill-in piece and a guy who I think will for sure they'll be able to afford. It's just hard to find free agent guys that you think the Timberwolves are really going to be able to afford. You know, maybe Mo Harkless. I don't know what his market is going to end up looking like, but that's a guy I think I would take a look at with the full mid-level. You know, Etuan Moore is just a really solid shooter that I think could be interesting. And then obviously Jay Crowder, just because I think, you know, the championship pedigree that he has playing in the finals this year, but also just the toughness that he brings on both ends of the floor and just the veteran, you know, presence in the locker room, I think is going to be really important just because the Timberwolves don't have a lot of those guys. And is something that I think they're going to need to find sooner rather than later, just because I don't think you can have a bunch of 24, 25, 26-year-old guys in a locker room and expect to be really successful, especially when shit hits the fan. And then the last guy who I think the Timberwolves should really take a good hard look at and probably make a run at would be, you know, I don't think Jamichael Green is going to decline his player option, so I wouldn't necessarily go with him. But Justin Holiday is the other one that I would think of from Indiana, just because he's a really, really good shooter, who's a much better defender than I think a lot of people give him credit for. So I think that's
the kind of archetype you seem to be going for. Is that that two-way wing or even more defensively minded wing who can still give you enough three-point shooting? Like, that seems to be the only thing that is kind of in surplus at the moment in this free agency class. Like, just like the draft class, it's really, the cupboards are really bare in the free agency class. So yeah, I agree. I think you need to get a wing, someone who can probably play a bit of small ball for. Like, I know Holiday's probably not that guy, but like Harkless, Derek Jones Jr. is still my first option just because I think he has elite defensive potential, albeit maybe a bit spotty on a play-by-play possession, you know, basis. But it's hard at the moment. It's just a 2020 year right now. Like, the free agency, the draft, like, none of it is working out when the Timberwolves really need it to.
I mean, the more I think about him, I think Holiday makes a lot of sense. I think there might be kind of a pseudo bidding war for Holiday, just because, you know, I think his contract this past year was, I think, well below what he could make. I think he'll get pretty close to the non-taxpayer mid-level, right at that $9 million, $9.5 million range. But I mean, just looking at his synergy right now, I mean, small sample size, but he was in the 100th percentile in handoffs, and then spot up 74th percentile, off screen 64th percentile. He was 90th percentile in jump shots, which is obviously really great, and 87th percentile in three pointers. He definitely fits the mold and hopefully would be a guy that they take a good look at. With the mid level though, I mean, is that something that you think it would make more sense for the Timberwolves to split up into, you know, two guys, or is that something you'd rather see them kind of throw all at one person?
I want them to throw it all at one person, but I don't know if there's a player that warrants that. And I think, you know, in a normal, you know, normalish kind of free agency class where, you know, in next year's where there seems to be a lot of good players in it and a lot of good role players as well, I think I'd be happy for them to just throw the whole, you know, $9.5 or whatever $1 million at one player. But I don't think with the roster the way it's constructed with Towns and Russell and their contracts, I don't think you can afford to overpay anyone. You can't afford to overpay Malik Beasley. You can't afford to overpay Derek Jones Jr., who I think's value tanked a little bit by not really being able to get on the floor during the playoffs. So I think you could probably get like Mo Harkless and Derek Jones Jr. if you like. Like, I reckon you could get one of them at $4 million and one at $5 million. Like, especially if you gave them.
Hope to get one at the biannual. Which is possible,
and then,
too.
And I think you could give Derek Jones Jr. probably the full MLE over a few years just because he's young, and you can probably try and bet on potential, you know, but it's...
I don't think they would have to, though.
No, I don't think he'd... I think he might get, like a three-year 21 or something. Like, I reckon, you know, maybe four, like, you know, 315 or something. Like, 5 to 7 million seems to be about right for him, because he did have a really good regular season, but he couldn't get on the court in the playoffs because he couldn't shoot. So teams see that, and every team needs the shooting. But I think he'd actually be really good in Minnesota as a four in Minnesota's team, just because they have enough shooting to cover him, and he's just a ridiculous help side defender. So and a good one on one defender as well. So Derek Jones Jr. is my quote unquote guy. In free agency, but there's really not a lot there. I think if you can split it up and get two guys who can give you 20 minutes a night, you've done pretty well.
Yeah, and I think that's possible too. Just because, you know, I think that there could be guys or could be teams that really just want to kind of keep their options open. And I think really just try and save as much as they can for next year.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. The teams who, you know, are high-profile destination teams like your Miami's, like at the moment, Milwaukee's still one of those, while they have Giannis. Dallas is always a team that attracts attention. Obviously, the Lakers, Boston, you know, Clippers, stuff like that. Like, I think those teams who have free agents, I think they're the ones that are probably gettable, just because, like, Miami aren't going to give Derek Jones Jr. any money if they don't have to, because they think they have a legitimate shot of landing Giannis next year, or landing, you know, Paul George or someone like that, like in a trade. So, yeah, I think guys who are coming out of contracts on those big teams who are looking to keep their cap space open for a run at someone next year, they're the guys that fall through the cracks a little bit, and I think they're the ones that Minnesota can kind of sweep up the scraps.
And that might be the best strategy for him too, because I don't think they're going to want to get in a bidding war with anybody, and I just don't think it makes a whole lot of sense for them to spend more than they have to, just because I think, again, they could take a similar, you know, approach that they took last year, where, you know, they could get guys that could get in the back end of the rotation on minimum deals or super cheap deals, and have those guys outplay what their perceived value is, and they become more positive trade chips that could contribute to a playoff team on a minimum deal, which obviously is really important, and kind of gives you a leg up on the buyout market, because you can trade the guy instead of buying him out and having another team pick him up, which I think could be important, and allows you to pull off deals like, you know, the one they pulled off for Beasley at the deadline this past year. So, so those are kind of the different scenarios that I would think about there.
We'll make this the last thing. But what are your thoughts on, like, Christian Wood? Like, I know there's been a lot of reports, Bobby Marks, a few other guys that say his value or his range is going to be about the MLE. Do you think he's a guy that Minnesota will even entertain the thought of, or do you think, like you said, like, the bidding war for him is just going to be too much to even dip your toe into, because at the full MLE, I think there'll be at least 10, 15 teams who'd offer Christian Wood a deal.
Yeah, I think Christian Wood would fit really nicely in Minnesota, but I don't think that there's a way that they would sign him without it being a sign and trade. And I don't know why Christian Wood would come to Minnesota over anywhere else. I mean, I understand the fact that the Timberwolves might have, you know, the space under the tax line to make that happen if they wanted to trade, you know, James Johnson and the rights to the player at 17. But again, that's just, I mean, that's just like tampering waiting to happen. Like, you've got to tamper if you want to make that happen. So, I'm Christian Wood. Like, I would love it if they somehow made it work, but I just don't necessarily trust that would work out.
I'm kind of in the same boat. I think that he'd be a really good fit, and obviously there's a hole at the power forward spot in Minnesota's rotation, but if he's got 15 teams offering him the same amount of money, I can't see a reason why he'd choose Minnesota even over, you know, a Boston or an LA. Like, if it's the full MLE, most teams are going to be able to give it to him, and that kind of really destroys Minnesota's hopes of being a team that stands out off the page for him.
Yeah, agreed, 100%.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it at that. We did have some other stuff to get into, but we kind of just rambled as we do, so we'll leave it at that. We'll definitely be back where we've got live draft podcast coming up in, what is it now, 3 weeks, a bit less than 3 weeks until the draft, so I'm looking forward to that, and I'm sure I'll probably have you on one more time before that. But thanks as usual, everyone. If you're listening to this, if go and check out Kane of Supers. Jack's piece will probably be out by the time you're hearing this, but if it's not, just keep your eyes peeled for that, because I can guarantee you it's going to be awesome, just like the Booker piece. And the Booker piece blew up on Twitter and made Jack famous for a week. So I'm sure the Simmons piece will do the same thing.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man, and it's always good being on with you and talking with you, and we've got an exciting 2.5 weeks to go here, and I'm just super excited to see what comes of it.
Yeah, for sure, man. Thanks for coming on, everyone else. Like, rate, comment, subscribe, all that good stuff, and I'll see you guys all next week.